this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to the New Jerusalem, I've traveled through East Texas, where many martyrs fell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. I heard that hoot owl singing as they were taking down the fence, and the stars above the barren trees were the only audience. And charcoal gypsy maidens and strut their feathers well. I nobody can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. See the big plantations burning, hear the cracking of the whips, smell sweet magnolia blooming, see the ghost of slavery ships. I can hear them tribes a moaning, hear the undertaker's bell. Sang the blues like Blind Willie McTell. There's a woman by the river with some fine young handsome man. He's dressed up like a squire, bootleg whiskey in his hand. There's a chain gang on the highway, you can hear them rebels yell. Nobody can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. Up in his heaven, we all want what's his, but power and greed and corruptible seed seem to be all there is. I'm staring out the window at the St. James Hotel, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell.
Thank y'all. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Wildflower Unitarian Universalist Church. We are so happy to see each and every one of you this morning. Please rise in body or spirit and join me in singing the first hymn, number 1, in our gray hymnal. May nothing evil cross this door.
Thank you.
Welcome to this morning's service. My name is Michelle Baker, and I am today's lay worship leader. We're so glad and happy that you're here today. We want you to know that you, in all of your wholeness and uniqueness, are enough. We all have different gifts and needs, and your gifts and needs are important here. I want to give a special welcome to our first time and returning visitors. After the service, please be sure and join us for refreshments and conversation in the community room in the building just to the left as you exit the sanctuary. We want to get to know you and answer any questions you may have. So here at Wildflower, we have many opportunities to invite speakers from our congregation and from the community at large to speak at here at Wildflower, and today is one of those days. Our speaker today is Steve Brooks. Steve is a charter Wildflower member who has mixed sermons and songs at more than 35 UU churches around Texas and beyond. He's a talented songwriter and wordsmith known for writing songs that had been recorded by more than 15 artists, including Slade Cleaves and Russell Crowe, and was featured on TV's I've Got a Secret as a six-time world pun champion. Don't mess with Steve. Our minister, Reverend Brian Ferguson, will be back in the pulpit next Sunday. So Unitarian Universalists, we start our services by lighting a chalice. Today, Dina McAweeney will light our chalice this morning. And now please join me in saying our chalice lighting words, which are printed in your order of worship. With the kindling of this flame, we affirm our commitment to accept life's gifts with grace and gratitude, and to use them to bless the world in the spirit of love. And now let's take a moment to welcome the people sitting around us, especially those you don't know well. Please rise in body or spirit and turn to the back of your gray hymnals for the responsive reading, number 597, Love versus Hate. I will read the standard type, and I invite you to read the text in italics. Never does hatred cease by hating in return. Victory breeds hatred. They who give up all thought of victory or defeat let us overcome violence with gentleness. Let us overcome the miserly by liberality.
My name is Kathy Kramer, and I'm this year's president of the board. Here at Wildflower, we believe that community matters. Our mission is growing spiritually together, spreading love, justice, and joy. Today it's all about love. So we love getting together to have fun, and we've been doing that on the second Friday of the month for a family potluck and game night. In spite of spring break, this past Friday, we had a great intergenerational group that played Mealborn, Apples to Apples, and Scruples. We hope you'll join us for the next one on April 13th. And many thanks to Dina McAweeney for making these events happen. Woohoo! Our minister, Reverend Brian Ferguson, is halfway through his 5-year term, and it's time for us to evaluate him. Voting members and pledging friends, please fill out the survey you received by email or fill out a hard copy in the community room. As much as we all love Brian, it's still important to share with the board what's working well and where improvement is needed. And as most of you know, Brian's mother died a couple of weeks ago, and he has been in Scotland with his family since her death. He will return to Austin this Friday, and we want to have messages of comfort and sympathy waiting for him on his desk when he enters his office. We've placed two clipboards on the chalice table with sheets of paper for those of you who would like to leave Reverend Ferguson a message. These sheets will then go inside a condolences card. Please feel free to come up to the chalice table after the service and leave your message for him. Thank you.
For those who are young in body or spirit, we invite you to come up front in the sanctuary here. It is time for all ages. Hi there. Hello, how are y'all doing this morning? So, I want to talk a little bit about superheroes. Do any of y'all have a favorite superhero? No? Wow. Things have changed since I was a kid. Aquaman, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man. Yeah, he was always my favorite. Well, have you seen any good superhero movies lately? No. Okay. You. What did you see? What did you like?
The Thor.
Thor. Uh-huh. That big Norse guy with the hammer. Well, something I wanted to say about, you know, superhero movies is that it's always clear who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And part of the formula for those movies, yeah?
Is it okay if my favorite is actually in between?
In between? Sure. Well, who's your favorite?
Sans.
Sans? Sans. I don't know Sans. All right. Well, I'm going to talk about the in between because while superhero movies are fun, in real life, it's really not always clear who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. Mostly in between, yes. Well, I want to tell you a story from back when, you know, I was y'all's age, and there was a game we used to play that thankfully I don't think kids play much anymore, but it was called Cowboys and Indians. Now, when we played the game, the cowboys, those of us who played the cowboys would be the good guys, and those who played the Indians would be the bad guys. The cowboys we thought were the good guys because, you know, they were bringing civilized life to the Wild West, and they were protecting the folks who were trying to make their living as farmers and ranchers out on the frontier. And the Indians were the bad guys because they were trying to drive the settlers out. And they were killing the cowboys. And it was never a fair fight because there would always be a lot more Indians with their bows and arrows than there were cowboys. Well, as I grew up, I discovered that I really had it backwards. Turned out that the more I learned about the Indians, the more they seemed like the good guys. Because, yeah, tell me why.
Because they're just trying to make a living, I guess. I'm not sure.
Because they are so dumb.
And because they were there first, they had lived on this land for thousands of years, and they had been taking pretty good care of this land. And on top of that, they had beautiful religious ceremonies and songs and dances. And as I found out more about the cowboys, I found out, well, that they were stealing the land from the Indians. And in real life, usually it was the cowboys and the soldiers who outnumbered, you know, the Indians. And there were a lot more Indians getting killed than there were cowboys. So as I grew up, I discovered that, well, the Indians were more the good guys and the cowboys were often the bad guys. And that's a lesson that, I've taken into the rest of my life, that as I look at the world, it's not always clear who the good guys and the bad guys are. And it's especially important that when we're fighting bad things in this world, that we don't end up becoming the bad guys ourselves. And with that, thanks for your time, and let us sing the children out. Time of meditation. You may close your eyes or open them as the Spirit moves you. Spirit of life, we strive to do good. We strive to be good people and to think of ourselves as good people. And yet, most of us know, when we are being honest with ourselves, that we also sometimes have thoughts of cruelty and destruction. And it is good for us to be aware of those thoughts. Because a central part of any spiritual life is the shining of light into darkness. And as long as we can recognize our own darkness and name our own darkness, we have power over it, and it loses its power over us. Let us now enter into a time of silence.
Now, if you'll join us, remain seated and join us in singing hymn number 137, We Utter Our Cry. The following reading was written by Steve Taylor, who's a PhD. It was posted on the website of Psychology Today in August of 2013, and it is from an article entitled The Real Meaning of Good and Evil. And it speaks to the fact that good and evil are not intrinsic, but are changeable characteristics. Most of us lies somewhere between the extremes of Gandhi and Hitler on the spectrum of human behavior. Sometimes we may behave badly when egocentric impulses cause us to put our needs before the welfare of others. Sometimes we behave in a saintly fashion when empathy and compassion impel us to put the needs of others before our own, resulting in altruism and kindness. The real difference between this idea of good and evil and the traditional concept is that empathy or lack of empathy aren't fixed. Although people with a psychopathic personality appear to be unable to develop empathy, for most of us, empathy, or goodness, is a quality that can be cultivated. This is recognized by Buddhism and most other spiritual traditions. As we practice meditation or mindfulness, and as we become less attached to materialism and status-seeking, we become more open and more connected, and so more selfless and altruistic. The fluidity of goodness is also recognized by the process of restorative justice, which is becoming more and more widely used within European justice systems. Rather than locking bad people away, which is unfortunately so widely practiced by the US penal system, restorative justice gives offenders the opportunity to meet their victims, to see how their crimes have affected them, which often leads to a sense of empathy for their victims, which in turn frequently leads to rehabilitation. This is an optimistic view of nature, but I would go even farther, because the goodness in human beings emerges when we are connected, when we spread out into empathy with one another. I believe that goodness expresses something fundamental about human nature, even if it might be sometimes difficult to see. Evil is an aberration, a form of pathology, as a psychopathic personality shows, which only emerges when we are broken off into disconnected fragments. So ends the reading. It is now time for our offering. We know that our financial contributions to this congregation come from sacrifice and hard work. We are so grateful for this and commit together to ensure the funds that we gather collectively do a greater good for ourselves and our world than they could have done alone. May there be an offering to sustain and grow the life and mission of this congregation. May we give in love and in hope. If you are visiting for the first time, please let the plate pass, as your presence here is gift enough. The offering will now be given, and thank you for your generosity.
When you see white men marching in the street, like the Ku Klux Klan without the sheets, when they get blessed by a presidential tweet, it's strange but true, welcome to the new abnormal. When your election's under an attack, my fancy bears playing hacky sack and making up alternatives to facts. This isn't spin, you're living in the new abnormal. The new abnormal, how things have changed. What's strange is that it doesn't seem so strange. Through a looking glass or down a wormhole, you've landed in the new abnormal. When by the side of Liberty stands a sign that reads no vacancy, except for those who can't afford the fee. You're tired and poor, get shown the door in the new abnormal. The new abnormal. strange that it doesn't seem so strange. Through a looking glass or down a wormhole, you've landed in new abnormal. It's just a dream, is what you tell yourself. Click your heels and you'll be someplace else. That doesn't make you doubt your mental health and curse your luck for getting stuck in the new abnormal. 'Cause what's the deal? This can't be real, the new abnormal, the new abnormal.
This reading comes from a book called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness by the great psychologist Erich Fromm. Man differs from the animal by the fact that he is a killer. He is the only primate that kills and tortures members of his own species without any reason. The degree of destructiveness increases with the increased development of civilization rather than the opposite. Precisely because evil is human, it is inside every one of us. The more we are aware of it, the less we are able to set ourselves up as judges of others. Even the most sadistic and destructive man is human, as human as the saint. He can be called a warped and sick man who has failed to achieve a better answer to the challenge of being born human. And this is true. He can also be called a man who took the wrong way in search of his salvation. The Old Testament view is that man has both capacities, that of good and that of evil, and that man must choose between good and evil, blessing and curse, life and death. Even God does not interfere in the choice. He helps by sending his messengers, the prophets, to teach the norms which lead to the realization of goodness, to identify the evil, to warn, and to protest. But this being done, man is left alone with his two strivings, that for good and that for evil, and the decision is his alone. Maybe man is both wolf and sheep, or neither wolf nor sheep.
Introduce myself, I thank the well-paid. I've been down a long, long year, stole brains, soul, and faith. I frowned when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. And I made damn sure that Pilate washed his hands and sealed his fate. Screamed in vain. I rode the tanks, held a remedies. When after all, it was you and me. Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I lay traps for the troubadours who got killed before they reached
fall of 2016, America was in a panic over evil clowns. I'm not making this up. From almost every state came reports of menacing harlequins coming out of the woods and trying to lure away children or scare the bejesus out of passersby. Most of the sightings were easily dismissed as hysteria. But perhaps, like most hysterias, they were symptoms of something deeper in the collective psyche. Maybe it was unease about a buffoonish character with carrot-colored hair who combined fear-mongering with farce as he ran for the highest office in the land. A year later, 100 young white supremacists paraded through the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Like the clowns of a year before, they wore dissonant outfits. In place of flaming crosses, they carried tiki torches. Instead of hoods, they wore polo shirts and khaki pants. They could have been your neighbors. While the president was praising some of them as fine people, I began dusting off an old phrase from my college days, the banality of evil. I never wanted to believe in evil. To me, the word had always reeked of fundamentalist religions and rigid moral judgments. People used it to divide the world into good guys and bad guys. I declined. I had seen too many good guys become so convinced of their own goodness that they turned into bad guys. I agreed with my friend Donna Glee Williams, who's a former psychiatric nurse. To her, the word is a label that gets applied to stubborn forms of mental illness. Unlike other labels like sick or broken, it writes a person off is impossible to heal. She concludes, I don't see anything to be gained from using the word evil to describe any part of creation. My attitude placed me comfortably within the Unitarian mainstream. We mention evil just once in our seven principles, and that's up at the level of power and structures. I suspect that that stems from our universalist heritage. We're passionate about inherent worth and dignity, and that's a hard concept to square with personal evil. We long to believe that human beings are essentially good. It's social systems and childhood traumas that twist them to act otherwise. Over the past couple of years, though, I've been rethinking my attitude as I have watched the rise of what I call the new abnormal. I suspect that many of you can relate. We see a surge in hate crimes, mass shootings on a near daily basis. We see a neo-fascist movement in politics and proud racists in the public square. Over and over, the thought has hit me that for the trends that I am witnessing, there is no word that fits better than evil. I began to study up on everything from scriptures to ethics to experimental psychology. I hoped I could better understand what's going on and what to do about it. This morning, I'd like to step into a topic where angels fear to tread and where demons run laps. I'd like to share some ideas on a theology of evil and how it might turn out to be a useful concept for religious liberals after all. Before I start digging into evil, let me explain what I mean by it. I propose to define evil as extreme malevolence. It's the combination of the two that sets being evil apart from simply being a jerk. And so I'll try to expand on them both. Malevolent intentions can feed on many kinds of negative drives: anger, hatred, cruelty, or revenge. But they all aim at the same goal: to do harm to someone else. Evil starts with the willingness to, with the wish or the willingness to damage others, whether it's for gain, for pleasure, or from a misguided sense of self-defense. Second, evil is an extreme form of that wish. It crosses over some behavioral boundary that we have set in our minds. It's hardly unusual, after all, to wish suffering on someone else. If the insults on my Facebook feed are any indication, not to mention my own thoughts, when another driver cuts me off on I-35, I imagine him roasting on some infernal spit in a painting by Hieronymus Bosch. Thankfully, most of us draw a line against obsessing on these wishes or acting on them. The other side of that line is where evil begins. But that's a rational definition. When I picture evil to myself, I usually see in my mind a demented individual, say, the Joker, the original killer clown from Batman. For you, it might be a serial killer or a genocidal dictator. Whatever our picture, the devil is laughing at us because he knows, if we don't, that a key trait of evil is deception. As Mick Jagger quotes him, "Confusing you is just the nature of my game." When I look at evil deeds and who actually commits them, the vast majority are not the work of a Jeffrey Dahmer or an Adolf Hitler. No, they're carried out by everyday people. Evil craves more than anything else to appear normal. For centuries, it was artists and writers who lifted the curtain on so-called normality to show us what lies behind. In recent decades, it's been psychologists. What could look more normal than a businessman? Guess again. A 2011 study from Switzerland compared personality profiles of 28 securities traders with those of 24 psychopaths from high security hospitals. The traders outscored the psychopaths in traits like egotism, willingness to take risks, and to hurt others to get ahead, explained a prison psychiatrist. They spent a lot of energy trying to damage their opponents. Psychologist Kevin Dutton, who has surveyed thousands of Britons for psychopathic traits, lists 10 professions with the highest concentrations. Topping his list are CEOs, lawyers, journalists, and salespeople. Says Dutton, a number of psychopathic attributes are actually more common in business leaders than in so-called disturbed criminals. Attributes such as superficial charm, egocentricity, persuasiveness, lack of empathy, independence, and focus. The good news, statistically speaking, is that while certain professions seem to attract them, 99% of us are not psychopaths. Does that mean that we're good guys and good gals? Or could evil fester among middle-class schlubs like you and me? One answer comes from a classic and controversial study known as the Stanford Prison Experiment. It would not surprise anyone who's ever been to a college fraternity. In 1971, Philip Zimbardo assigned 24 male students the roles of guards and inmates in a mock prison. Student guards were issued uniforms and batons and instructed to call the student prisoners by numbers rather than their names. Within a few days, the guards had gone far beyond their instructions. They were putting fellow students in solitary confinement, forcing them to relieve themselves in buckets and making them sleep naked on concrete floors. One-third were displaying full-blown sadistic tendencies, reported Zimbardo, after he cut the experiment short. One student guard later confessed, "I practically consider the prisoners cattle." Said another, "Power can be a great pleasure." 10 years earlier, Yale professor Stanley Milgram paid 40 local men to administer electric shocks to an unseen test subject. A supervisor in a lab coat told them that the shocks were meant to jog the subject's memory. After each wrong answer, a tester was supposed to deliver a stronger shock. The tester did not know that the machine was phony and that the torture victim was an actor. Although most testers asked to quit when they heard screams and banging on the wall, most of them continued when they were given orders. In the end, 65% of them cranked the dial to its maximum strength. Milgram's methods have since been copied by nearly a dozen researchers around the world, and many have gotten comparable outcomes. The experiment was motivated, Milgram later said, by the war crimes trial of Adolf Eichmann, who had overseen the shipping of Jews to Nazi death camps. Milgram concluded, one would be able to find sufficient personnel for those camps in any medium-sized American town. It was the same trial that inspired the philosopher Hannah Arendt to coin the expression, the banality of evil. She wrote, the trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him, and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, that they were, and still are, terribly and terrifyingly normal. If it's normal to be capable of evil, it also seems normal to avoid facing it and looking it in the mirror. It's a natural human instinct to want to point an accusing finger at the other person. It's so much easier to see in someone else, not to mention it lets me off the hook, writes religious historian Jeremy Burton Russell. The demonization of others is possible when we fail to recognize the demon within ourselves. It is perhaps the most dangerous form of self-deception, Once we project our instincts for cruelty onto others, then all hell can break loose. Bob Dylan's song Blind Willie McTell catalogs episodes throughout American history. More recently, we've seen Vietnam, shock and awe, and Abu Ghraib. In each instance, average Americans give themselves license to kill while assuring themselves that they're on the side of right. They are, in fact, making America great again. As psychologist L.W. Doob sums it up, in order to persuade a good moral man to do evil, then it is not necessary first to persuade him to become evil. It is only necessary to teach him that he is doing good. The phenomenon of projection helps to explain why so much evil throughout the ages has been committed in the name of religion. Fundamentalist religions project their inner demons out onto the entire cosmos. The ultimate source of evil resides in supernatural entities like Satan. I would be remiss if I did not give the devil his due. I don't subscribe to a disembodied spirit, but I do see him as a symbol, as a psychic archetype, onto which people project their own darkest desires. In that light, he can show us psychological truths that we would rather not see in ourselves. Take his origin story. Lucifer loses a civil war and gets cast out into a place of infinite darkness. If I see hell as my own shadow side, I notice that it has the most power over me at the times when I'm least aware of it. Carl Jung saw Satan's story as a metaphor for civilization and its losing battle to repress its own irrational side. Wrote Jung, "Modern man does not understand how much his rationalism has put him at the mercy of the psychic underworld." Or consider the concept of demonic possession. Take it literally, and I think of Linda Blair's head spinning around. But psychologically, when I am seething with anger, I often lose my powers of will and reflection. Afterwards, I feel as if some other being has temporarily taken me over. As experimental psychology reminds me, I can also lose my moral compass when I fall under the pull of social pressures, conformity, groupthink, or obedience to authority. But if the devil personifies our cruelest instincts, he also can offer us some useful ideas on how to deal with them. He cautions us that we can't destroy evil, at least not for long. It is a permanent feature of our psyches and our societies. The most effective antidote is not to eradicate it, but to expose it, to shine a light on something that's hidden and make it visible. In the social sphere, that was a basic insight of nonviolent tacticians like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. We are seeing the process right now in movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. People use personal testimonies and eyewitness videos to expose entrenched systems of evil, ones that society has long swept under its carpet. And however slowly, those systems are beginning to change. The tale of the devil also warns us not to project evil out onto a single supervillain. It's tempting to focus on someone like the person in the Oval Office. But in truth, evil is woven into a wider system. Its power comes from millions of citizens who see racism and fascism as legitimate solutions to their problems. It also comes from the urge to paint our political opponents as demons, whether they're on the left or on the right. What frightens me the most, though, is the erosion of taboos. Until recently, it was socially unacceptable for high public officials to race bait, to threaten opposing candidates with jail, to profiteer from public office, and to make up alternative facts when the real ones didn't suit their purposes. It's not that these taboos were never broken, but they were broken with a certain sense of shame. Richard Nixon tried hard to cover up his misdeeds. Today, the culprits brag about them. Roughly a third of our population cheers them on, while others make excuses or look the other way. The rest of us feel like we're fighting a rearguard action against accepting it all as a new normal. It's in this fight I would like to suggest that a theology of evil might be a valuable ally. If the past century has taught us anything, it's what can happen when we lose our taboos. It's taught us how thin the veneer of civilization can be, how fragile our values like democracy and decency. In our age of the new abnormal, we need to rebuild the social walls that divide tolerable behavior from extreme malevolence, from acts and policies that cause extreme human damage. As Mick Jagger puts it, we're in need of some restraint. We might even find that traditional Christianity had a point in its skeptical view of human goodness. Perhaps human beings are neither essentially good nor essentially evil, essentially loving nor essentially cruel. Really, we're all these things. We have the free will, moment by moment, to choose which of our conflicting impulses will come out on top. But our wills can be weak and fallible. To have an awareness of evil and of our innate capacity for it can paradoxically help to tip our scales to the side of love. Our choice is not between good and evil. It's about how we will confront evil. The more we try to destroy it, the more we risk doing evil deeds ourselves. But we have another option. We can challenge racism, violence, and greed with a humble awareness of our own dark places and of the dragons that dwell within. When we label certain behaviors as evil, we strengthen our defenses against them, both in society at large and within our own souls. The late Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn knew a thing or two about evil. His life's work was to expose the operations of the secret Soviet prison system. He once wrote, "If only it was all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, that it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and to destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a part of his own heart?" I invite y'all to rise now in body or spirit and join in hymn number 1022 in the Teal Hymnal, "Open the Window."
Thank you.
You may remain standing for the benediction and the extinguishing of the chalice. As we go forth today, let us go forth knowing that part of being human is having the capacity to do both good and evil. Let us be grateful that we belong to communities that support us in doing good and helping people rather than hurting them. But let us be humbly aware that we were living in other places or other times, in societies which pressured us to collaborate with evil. We can't be certain that we would resist. Let our awareness strengthen our resolve to confront the evils in front of us in the darkness that now hangs over our country, that we may build a land that truly supports standing on the side of love. Amen, and blessed be.
Just like to remind you of the cards for Brian. If you want to leave a message after the service, please come up to the chalice table.